Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Hey, GabFest listeners, it's David Plotz. I'm here backstage at the Bell House in Brooklyn, getting ready for the show you're about to hear. John and Emily are tapping away on their computers behind me. Before we start the show, I need to tell you, the Slate Political GabFest is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer when you visit Stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST. Now, on with the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political GABFEST for April 10th, 2015, the Live at the Bell House edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson of Slate and CBS News is at my far left, and at my near left is your hometown, New York Times' Emily Bazelon. Those cheers were those cheers
up.
For...
that was for both of us.
That was for both of you, yeah. We are live at the Bell House in Gowanus. There's a packed house, which we can barely see, but I understand you're packed. So let us know that you're packed right now.
And also let us know if you're packing too, because
And I have to say, I'm a little bit disappointed. I've heard tell of your Brooklyn beards before, but I come to Brooklyn,
and
all you
one.
Brooklynites, you can pull your mingy little chin hairs in shame, because a Washingtonian has the bushiest beard in the house.
But so. I think they're thinking like, you know, the beard, like that was last year.
Probably. Yeah. That's right.
That's like. That's right. You're the Brussels sprouts and kale of, like, facial hair.
I had Brussels like, sprouts and...
They've
like,
moved on to, like, parsnips and, like, all
they're
kinds
like,
of
we live
crazy.
In Queens. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't get it. On this week's GABFEST, we will talk about the murder of Walter Scott in North Charleston. Will it change what the other murders have not changed? Then we'll talk about President Rand Paul and what his presidency will be like. It will be good for you guys, I'm sure. And we'll talk about the Rolling Stone fiasco. We'll autopsy the terrible ridiculousness that Rolling Stone foisted upon all of us a few months ago and the very interesting report that's just come out about it. And of course, we'll have cocktail chatter and we'll have a Q&A with you. Michael Slager, a police officer in North Charleston, South Carolina, on Saturday murdered, I think we can safely say murdered, a person... Walter Scott, a 50-year-old man, he had stopped in a traffic stop for a broken brake light. The video, a video taken by a passerby who did something in the moment that I think we all wish we have the bravery and resourcefulness to do. If we were presented with something similar, made the front page of the New York Times. It has changed, I think, the conversation around police and violence, but we've said this before. So, Emily, we have had in the last couple of years just episodes. We have Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, which is a slightly different situation, Tamir Rice, and of course Michael Brown, and now we have Walter Scott is another victim. Why would we think that this will change things in a way that these other deaths did not?
Well, this is incredibly clear. And by saying that, I don't want to say that the other cases weren't, because I think you know, Eric Garner's shooting, Tamir Rice's shooting. Michael Brown's shooting became more complicated over time the more we learned about it. But this is very stark. You watch that video and you feel like you're watching a snuff film. And the officer, Michael Slager, was immediately charged with murder. So in some sense, it's a simpler...
Not immediately.
Not immediately.
Well,
that's true.
It was
Saturday. It took the video. You're right. That's a really good point. Right. It felt immediate because we didn't know about the shooting, nationally speaking. I didn't know about it until the video broke. But you're right. And the other part of the story that I think is should change the conversation, but is perhaps the most unsettling, is that the official report from Slager about this shooting was full of lies and was the account that one feels like one hears every time there's a police shooting. Oh, this was an armed man. There was a struggle. I had no choice. And the video is just incredibly stark. That's just not true. It's not what happened.
That last point you made strikes me is that it seemed like he knew a script to say. I felt threatened. I discharged my weapon. Like that he was lapsing into what kind of wasn't just his own making, that this is something that was in his head. If this should ever happen, that he knew immediately the script, which obviously the question at the heart of this is how much of this is a script, both specifically what he said, but also his reaction to the moment, that a script that is pre-written.
Well, I imagine in his training, he learned that script because the Supreme Court has said that the police may use lethal force when they feel threatened or when they think there is a threat to someone else's life. And so I would assume that's sort of spelled out and that police know that is what they are supposed to say.
Right. I guess what I meant is when you know you weren't threatened, you default to the script as opposed to, like, we all know, I mean, what it would feel like to be actually threatened.
Right. I mean, one of the remarkable things about that video is how exceedingly calm the officer appears to be throughout it all. Now, no doubt he wasn't because he was shooting a person, killing somebody in cold blood. And I can't imagine he was that calm, but he calmly calls it in. He walks over. He very deliberately then goes and apparently plants the taser. So his calmness is surprising in the moment that you would think would be so disturbing.
And it's chilling that he handcuffs Scott as opposed to trying to do any CPR or providing any medical care, right? That's another really awful part of that video.
So immediately what's come out of this is this idea that, well, everything should be videotaped at all times. Every police interaction should be videotaped. So first of all, Emily, do you think we're heading to that? We had this fucking conversation 6 months ago and 6 months before that. Why would having the conversation again make a difference?
Because we saw the actual video. I mean, when you said it was on the front page of the New York Times, it wasn't just the story was on the front page. You had tile photographs of it going down. And if you watch the video, as Emily said, you are watching a live murder. We didn't have that. Now you did in the Garner case, but...
Yeah, you did in the Garner case.
Yeah, all right.
So did the Garner case change things drastically? It didn't appear to.
So this is a slow struggle, right? I mean, these kinds of changes take a long time. There's a lot of institutional inertia. There's resistance, too, from some police departments. On the other hand, a few police departments have tried this, and it's been relatively successful. So, and, you know, the Justice Department has been at least recommending the idea of videotape. So, you know, I think will more departments try to adopt this? Yes. Will it immediately, like, sweep the country and become a uniform change? No, that's not going to happen.
Emily, you had, as we were emailing before deciding on the topics, you had this interesting analogy, which is if you look at education reform, there's the same sense that the teachers' unions, but rightly or wrongly, but this sense that teachers' unions were resistant to change, but that there was an alternative education establishment in charter schools, which provided a sort of alternate view, which put a huge amount of pressure on public education to make changes, but that in law enforcement there isn't there's no alterna policing to do that.
Right. So, I mean, I was thinking about the idea, okay, most police, we can trust most police. I want to believe that. As skeptical as these incidents make me, I still hold on to that. And yet, you know, police unions, fraternal organizations have a record of essentially supporting all police and not expelling the few bad apples. I mean, I'm I'm exaggerating maybe, but, you know, to some degree, resisting strong internal affairs departments and standing by almost everyone. And we used to see that with teachers, right? And then there was publicity about rubber rooms and terrible teachers and teacher evaluations made easier to expose bad teachers. But I don't think that's really why the unions, the teachers' unions, changed. It was really this countervailing pressure from charter schools. And we're never going to have that alternative in law enforcement. So how do we see the same, you know, really like quick distancing and ejection of cops like Slager, who have shown themselves to be so unworthy of the public?
Well, they
trust.
Did quickly eject. I mean, everybody will.
They
eject
charged
this
him
guy
immediately
and say this is an aberration.
Right,
and
but then isn't he? I mean, I don't mean to say this in a way that I think he deserved to have been charged with murder. But I also feel like now he's going to stand for all these other cops who were not charged.
Well, for some people he will. For others, he'll be the one guy who was horrible and awful, and the rest of them aren't like this.
Do you think the lesson that we've learned is that actually there are a huge number of these incidents all the time, and thank goodness we're now starting to videotape it so that we can learn it, or that actually these incidents are really aberrational, that they're aberrational?
Well, we're going to know when everybody gets video cameras, which is what's going to happen. I mean, it's already happened in this police force. They've already said they're going to equip all the officers with cameras. And then we'll see, and the test will be, does this happen? Do innocent people get gunned down, or not innocent, but certainly not committing any kind of crime that deserves to be shot 8 times in the back while you're running away at speed that is basically fast walking, which is what's so gruesome about this footage. Or what the police say, which is if we're constantly having to second guess our movements, it puts us, the police, in a dangerous position because we can't react fast enough in dangerous situations. And so the videotape will tell once we have lots and lots of footage of all of this going down.
I mean, I do wonder, and I wonder, what do you guys think? I mean, he's somebody, he may have taken the taser, Scott may have taken the taser from the officer, and the officer may well have perceived, although clearly he was wrong, he may have perceived that Scott had the taser with him as he was running away. What should Slager have done in that circumstance?
Well, certainly could have tried to get Scott to stop, and he, you know, could have.
He did try to get Scott to stop.
Yeah, and he did.
Shot him.
Right. So I guess, right, does a police officer in that situation have to let someone flee? Could they shoot but not shoot to kill? Would that be permissible? How dangerous is it to have someone run away with the taser? I mean, in the end, when you see this, it seems like absolutely you would choose having Scott on the list with the taser gun, but maybe that's not, is that a fair thing to ask of the cop whose taser it is?
Yeah.
I think it is.
It's fair to, like, not take a person's
life.
Right,
and when you think about the standard about
also, by the way, could have caught him. Not running very fast. Like, that's what's so gruesome about this. I mean, he wasn't not only a threat to the cop, he wasn't a threat to anybody else because he was barely...
He wasn't running fast.
Yeah,
he wasn't a jackrabbit.
I mean, that's what makes this so...
Can
revolting.
I ask one more question? You know, with both Ferguson and with this shooting, we're talking about relatively small communities in which there's a huge imbalance, mostly African-American population, mostly white police force. The residents today, and it was very eerie reading, it was like reading about Ferguson, everyone says, like, this isn't really a surprise. There's been a lot of tension with this police force here for a long time. This was like a simmering, essentially. But because these are smallish places as opposed to like Los Angeles post Rodney King, or I guess New York, it feels like every single, right? I mean, there's been so much attention focused on Ferguson. What?
I need a verb. Every single what?
What would it take to make change community by community? Because you can have a big city police department reform that affects the experiences of millions of people.
Right. You mean because it has to happen, because these small... These are sort of backwater police departments. It takes a while for things to filter down. It's not like there's not as much attention spotlight on it, which you would have in New York with the New York tabloid press. And
right, or the spotlight
you can't
of the media.
Expect it to change quickly.
The spotlight is like all about a small community, and that, you know, Ferguson just had elections. So you can expect change, but it is small bore. It's not going to change everything. Yeah.
I thought the whole point of what the Justice Department, what Eric Holder was doing, was to sort of nationalize this issue so that you would create national standards for police behavior around these things. And maybe we're getting there. It's just that
It takes...
Right. We didn't get there this week.
Right, and this is like the weakness, I suppose, in our federalist system that Eric Holder can say whatever he wants and try to push. But, you know, why is some community in, I don't know, Oregon, Wisconsin, whatever, going to be more likely to adopt those reforms because of what happened here?
All right, so just as a last question, actually, I want to do a little audience poll because John mentioned watching the video. We've all watched this video. I would like to find out by audible clapping if you have watched the video or not watched the video. Have you watched the video? Have you not watched the video?
Can I ask a third? Okay. Were you going to ask a third question?
No.
Have you known about the existence of the video and chosen not to watch it?
Interesting. So, John, you are really somebody who thinks a lot about this idea of restraint, and we were talking about the ISIS videos, which none of us have watched. Why do we watch this video? Why are we incumbent? Why do I feel like it's incumbent on me to watch this video and not to watch an ISIS video? Like, what is it that is in that?
Yeah, I don't know. I got 7,000 words, and I still don't know the answer. That's this piece. If any of you have been listening to the show for the last 8 years... I'm going to tell you about a piece about restraint.
You know what? The piece is just going to dribble out on the podcast. You never actually have to write it. You've gotten so much
mileage. There's this view I've always had that if you could just get the conversation you have with your editor before you write the story to be transcribed, then you wouldn't have to go through the pain of actually having to write the story. And that's the way I feel about this one. So this story idea came out of all of these horrible moments of video footage that we all know about. And this is the most recent example, and also it's a particularly special one. But I mean, from the plane crashes that TV shoves in our face whenever we're at the airport about to get on one, or the basketball leg injuries we're all forced to watch, or various football players abusing their wives. These videos are forced in front of us, and we have to make a choice. And sometimes we don't get to make a choice because they're everywhere, because the screens are the tile of our basically lives in the deli, in the airport. So this is a slightly different case, though, because there's a public, there's something
we do learn, but we learn, when you hear that ISIS has beheaded someone and there's a video up, watching that video does not teach you anything you don't know from knowing that someone's
been... Well, how do you know? You haven't watched it, neither have I.
It seems very unlikely that it's going to teach you anything you don't know, which is that this is an act of terrible brutality and someone dies at the end in a terrible way. In this case, you were learning something about an important issue of the day, which is police behavior towards poor people, towards minorities, and you're watching it unfold in a kind of secret way, in a way that you're never allowed to see in real life. And so it's a window on something which, as a citizen, you want to know about and need to know about and have no other way of learning about.
And you also have lots of fictionalized versions of bad people shooting at cops, being criminals. Like, you know what that looks like. But this is a story out there that you now know what this looks like, which is basically treating another person like an animal.
And it's also a chapter, as you started out by saying, in this kind of serial nightmare we've been living in, which there have been other videos. So, I mean, I was immediately curious, and I wanted to know how this case fit into all these other shootings that I've been following.
So what I've been struggling with, though, is... So let's assume you feel like this is a piece of information you have to watch because to be an engaged citizen in the world, you have to come to it. If you watch it, as I did this morning, it took over. You know, there went the morning, because... you can't engage in ideas and think, oh, yeah, okay, whatever, video, and move on. So I think you have to, A, not have this stuff forced in your face, but I think also you have to, like, come up with a plan for how to deal with this. Like, when we all had a dinner hour, you know, and this was on the evening news last night, which was a big choice for the broadcast networks to make, to put the murder of a person on TV, that doesn't happen. Like, you know, the news hour was 6:30, and you would kind of, that's where you would watch the news, and that you would sort of be ready for it. You have to, like, plan your moment of horrible intake of bad news, or else it just can take over your life. Maybe not. Maybe other people are coarsened to this and they can watch it and move on. I can't.
All right, let's move on. The
Iceman.
What kind of transition did you expect me to make in that moment, honestly? The Slate Political Gabfest is brought to you by Stamps.com. One of the best recommendations that small businesses can take is to use Stamps.com. Stamps.com makes mailing and shipping convenient and saves you time and money. You can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your computer. And once you try it, you won't go back to making time-consuming trips to the post office. To get you started, Stamps.com has a special offer for Political GabFest listeners like you. Just use our promo code GABFEST to get a no-risk trial with a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale that calculates the exact postage for letters and packages, so there'll be no guesswork, and up to $55 in free postage. So, for this special offer, go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. So, Senator Rand Paul announced his presidential campaign this week. He's staking out a new plot of land in the GOP, a sort of libertarianish place. He is hoping to cobble together an unusual coalition of, who is it, of stoners, of people who don't like the government snooping on them, of people who are skeptical about U.S. foreign policy intervention overseas. Prison reformers. And the idea, John, correct me if I'm wrong, is that he can expand the base of the party, which has become basically a party of old white guys, and he can expand that base and bring in a new voters and thus, first of all, win himself the nomination and then be a strong candidate in the general election because he's going to get some of these young voters, some minority voters that no other candidate in the GOP field is going to get. Is this a credible case?
Separate and apart from Rand Paul, or I mean, can a human do this, or can Rand Paul do this?
Can we just submit? Yeah,
you could answer in two.
It's not a credible. Sorry, I know you're the political analyst, but I have trouble taking this premise seriously.
You mean that I'm the political analyst, or because
I have to think about
if you can't take it seriously, we got to work to do. Go ahead. No.
I feel like maybe you'll pretend to take it seriously, and that we're dutifully giving each of these candidates their due. Like, we talked about Ted Cruz, and these people are not going to be president. That's just not going to happen. So I'm interested in this candidacy.
Is Rand Paul less going to be president than Ted Cruz?
Do you think
is he a less plausible?
Who's going to win the not
candidate?
President nomination?
Yeah.
Because Michelle Bachmann won the not
he's
president.
He's more interesting
nomination
to me than Ted Cruz, but I think he's just as implausible. I don't know. It's a tough
one. Is he just as implausible, John?
Oh, God. Hold on. I'm sorry. I'm the one who's supposed to be dutiful.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your original question. Okay. So, first of all, before answering your original question, this is going to be very, very interesting, right? It's a new gambit. It's not like the old style approach. So that's interesting. We should all be in favor of something that's interesting and shakes things up. It's hard to do for a couple of reasons. He's trying to be all things to all people. So when you go out to Iowa and you talk to all the Ron Paul fans, these were people who, and Ron Paul could have a candidacy and he didn't need a lot of money because he had people who'd walk across the state for him. They loved him, and they loved him in part because he was just constantly poking his finger in the eye of both the Republican establishment and the Democratic establishment and the phonies, and it was energizing to hear him constantly irritate other candidates. Rand Paul is not exactly doing that. So he's not being as exciting as his father was, and yet for the establishment or the kind of your regular Republican, he's also not as, you know, he doesn't have the governing experience of Scott Walker and Jeb Bush. He doesn't have the foreign policy views of everyone else. He's not as much of a social conservative. A lot of the coverage of the announcement said he was trying to kind of appeal to everyone, which he was.
But he's not going to get the social conservative vote.
Well, so he was trying to appeal to everyone but the social conservatives. In his announcement, there was no piece of candy for that group. There was for all other groups. So I think he's kind of all over the place. What he does have is he has an appeal to younger voters. The question is, can he grow the pie within his own party? Can he grow the pie of voters in the general election? And how much does he just need to be seen doing that? So there are a number of Republicans who think, gee, we've lost a lot of the popular vote in the last several elections. We need a new formula. And so all of the candidates are coming up with their own ways to solve that problem. And so this is his way of solving it. Your case needs to be just plausible enough to win in the caucuses, because you're not going to get a huge African American vote in the Iowa caucuses or in New Hampshire. So, you know, as a practical matter, it's not going to pay off in a huge number of people voting. But you could imagine a case in which somebody says, hey, here's my theory for the general election. And people say, oh, okay, I buy that. Now I'm going to vote for you. Also, we've got so many people running in the Republican Party. We need to kind of readjust our thinking in terms of these contests, because you can win with 21% of the vote or 22% of the vote. And Rand Paul has a floor, which is to say he has a group of people who are really going to vote for him, more so probably than anybody other than Huckabee. But he also has a ceiling. So his
Huckabee
floor...
Huckabee is the credible
he's
social conservative.
Well, in Iowa, he has a couple of things. He has the organization he built last time.
And sorry, I interrupted your train of thought.
He's a true believer for social conservatives. And third, he's been on Fox News for the last several years, speaking directly to the constituency he's trying to get to vote for him. So he's tilled a lot of ground beforehand. So I think he has a kind of floor. The question for Rand Paul is, what's his ceiling? And the big problem there for him is foreign policy.
So, Emily, why are you so exceedingly skeptical of the Paul campaign?
He just seems like too much of a maverick. And in the end, the 21%, if it comes without any kind of establishment backing, if it seems like it would never translate, I just don't. Who are the Republicans? How could there be enough Republicans or enough of anyone who, you know, don't want us to intervene at all? And then also are very anti-government, anti-spending, anti-tax, and think that prison reform is really important and think it's okay to support not vaccinating your kids. It's such a weird amalgam of views. I don't who are these people?
Well,
if this weren't a moment where foreign policy has suddenly erupted as a big issue, if there weren't ISIS and Russia, would he be a more credible candidate? I think he's been hurt by the calendar.
He's been hurt by the changing world, but
that's when called reality.
When people elect presidents, they go, the world might change and we need... So what I think he has a couple of fundamental challenges to his argument. One is that on domestic policy, he's saying, don't trust anybody else because I've been there talking about liberty and being more pure than anybody else for ages. So no matter what anybody else says today, look at their past record. Okay, got him on domestic affairs. But on foreign affairs, he's making the exact opposite case, which is, don't pay so much attention to what I said when I was campaigning for my dad and all this other stuff and how I say everybody in Washington wants ground troops everywhere at any war, which sounds like what an isolationist would say. He's saying, don't listen to all the stuff I said in the past. I'm with you today. That doesn't work in that way. And also because it's not the situation that we have now. What people in the Republican Party voting on the question of foreign affairs are worried about is the situation we're going to have tomorrow. And when new and weird things happen, will he default to the right position?
Shouldn't we as citizens and me as a left-leaning citizen, Emily as a left-leaning citizen, John is, who knows what John is. But shouldn't we be super enthusiastic about the Paul campaign in the sense that so much of the purpose of losing presidential candidates is to force other candidates to come to their position?
Yes.
And so shouldn't we be, regardless of whether you think he can be elected president, regardless of whether you think he ought to be a good president, as a citizen, you should be excited about the idea that he can, insofar as you believe in criminal justice reform and marijuana reform and, you know, less interventionism abroad, that you want that and less surveillance, that he's going to force the GOP to go
there.
Yeah, you
want him on stage in the debate. Absolutely. May he serve his function well.
Yeah, that's why I started off by saying, you know, this is what's so exciting about him. Not only is he has his views, but he's also a risk taker. So he's going to push the other candidates. And that's what Ron Paul used to do, which is just force other candidates to articulate what their views were in a specific way and talk about things like
the gold standard.
No.
Sorry, that was mean.
He actually didn't talk about the gold standard that much. Yes, he did. But in debates, he talked about to foreign policy hawks. He said, you know, he posed the question, is what America is doing overseas inciting and encouraging terrorism as much as it is tamping it down? And wherever you stand on that question, you should be able to handle it. And there were some candidates who didn't handle it so well. And so, yes, and that's why the Democratic Party is in such a mess, because there's nobody to test their candidate, which is bad for their candidate. And it's terrible for the conversation.
Right.
Because if you look at what Barack Obama did with Iran, it is the culmination of a policy that he was forced to articulate by Hillary Clinton in the debates when he talked about sitting down with the Iranians with no preconditions. Huge debate in that party because they had a big fight and they had to find things where they differed so they could have a big fight over it. It's fantastic. It sends you into the nooks and crannies to go find things you disagree about and then have a big debate in front of people who are listening. That's fantastic.
Let's actually pivot to that, because the presidential candidates have become sort of like blockbuster movies. Everyone gets to open one a week. So Rand Paul opened this week, Marco Rubio opens next week, and Hillary Clinton will open the week after that. I think she's going to open big. She's going to do $140 million.
Iron Man is in all.
It's
going to
be better than Fast and Furious 7. But so John, do you think that, or Emily, one of you, you're the lady, so maybe it's a Hillary topic, so maybe you want to. I did that just to get that rage in the audience.
I think that's what they call irony in Brooklyn.
So she's opening her campaign headquarters in Brooklyn, and she'll probably be doing like live hangouts in the Bell House, like town halls in the Bell House. But
I wonder if there are any Hillary staffers here.
When you
here.
Think about the Hillary, are there any Hillary staffers here? They will not admit it. No one's going to admit it. When you think about it, she has, you know, 20 months really between now and the general. I think it's about 20 months. There's nothing for her to do. What is it that she is going to do during this period? And it's, I think what John points out is like, this is a very fraught moment for her, right?
Right. Well, she could create a fake opponent or hope that a real one materializes, because she sort of needs a sparring partner to work out all the kinks and have debates with and have these arguments with. But what if that doesn't materialize? I would say the best thing she could do would be to go really small and try to have the kinds of events where she connects with people, because it seems like one of the mistakes she made the last time around, and now I am stealing from Jason Zangerli's piece in New York Magazine this week, was that she did, in the beginning of the primary season against Obama, she did a lot of like big, arid events where people didn't feel connected to her and she seemed distanced and cold. And it was only late in that primary season where she started doing a better job of connecting with voters. So if she has 20 months or like tons of time, at least before the real general election race starts, she should like go everywhere and talk to small groups of people.
Small, really small, like hot tubs.
Yeah, that could be rough. How many of us are there in the United States?
Is that what she's going to do, John?
Yeah. So, do you see how confidently I said that? But yes. So the thinking is, she has only become surrounded by more of a sense of majesty, imperial. I mean, she's got the Secret Service. She's got the black SUVs. She's got all the titles, the, you know, Madam Secretary, former senator. So all of that contributes to this idea that she's a million miles away from regular people.
And she just did this very imperious thing of using her private email server doing a bad job of explaining it.
Right, and gives the speeches and all that.
Right.
Makes lots of money. So the way to fix that, this is sort of analysis and reporting. Go to Iowa, right? So you can't go to, I mean, it's hard to...
You can visit every town in Iowa.
Well, you can go and do in small events in Iowa. It's inexpensive in Iowa, which is good for campaign. Iowa is a swing state, so you want to spend time in Iowa, even though she doesn't have anybody to really face other than Martin O'Malley. It's not that she doesn't have anybody to face. She doesn't have yet a challenger, you know, really putting her through her paces. So she goes to Iowa because it's a swing state. You want to build an organization there. You also get to test out fun little organizational stuff there that you can then apply in other states. But also she gets a chance to be in close contact with voters in Iowa where they're habituated to that kind of thing. They expect it. And both for her image, but also for her kind of political message, she wants to be in smaller groups. So
she could move to Iowa for months.
Yeah.
And then like
even if she doesn't have
New Hampshire and South Carolina.
Even if she doesn't, in New Hampshire, another swing state, and Nevada, swing state. So she should just spend the time in those three states, and that's, you know, probably what she will do. The question is if you can pull that off, if you're her and you can pull that off when you've got like 17 news crews from Japanese TV, wherever she moves, there is a huge, band that follows behind her.
Does any of that test her in the way that a campaign tests her? No, it doesn't.
No. I mean, look at the way they were tested. They tested each other in 2008. They got in the foot race to be more specific about healthcare, about foreign policy, about the poor, until John Edwards dropped out and then nobody talked about the poor anymore and still haven't talked about the poor since then. Although there are still, it turns out, 50 million poor people. So, that's a perfect example, actually. John Edwards talked about the poor. Democrats had to start talking about the poor when he dropped out of the race. Barack Obama promised that he would, make that a constant source of conversation. And then when the political challenge disappeared, the conversation disappeared.
So does there any chance that O'Malley or someone else could actually provide a real goad? And does Hillary's campaign quietly encourage the development of someone else's candidacy so that it becomes a real challenge?
People who have her interest at heart want her to face a challenger. They think she's talented.
But can you manufacture it?
Well, she's got lots of wealthy contributors who perhaps could like create a person.
They could
actually. Many of them are in Hollywood. There could be some actors who are. So what's the case for Martin O'Malley? Well, he's been a mayor.
Oh, come on. We people, there's only so much time, John. Do this quick.
All right. So he's been a mayor and a governor and dealt with like real people's problems on a really gritty,
day-to-day basis.
Okay, enough. Let's move on.
And that's the opposite of her political experience. And so he can, and to the extent that people in the Democratic Party, at least in the base of the party, are looking for a really robust conversation about income inequality, and voters are wondering if the candidate has lived a life or has come in touch with a life where you have to ride the bus across town when you're moving from when you're going from your first job to your second job, and you know, and then you maybe have a third job, and somebody who can speak with fluency about that from personal experience or from personal contact with it might have some kind of an inroad. But it's like a huge, massive hill to climb.
Okay, let's move on to our third topic. I mean, I am interested, like, just in the Hillary thing. If anyone spots
David,
her in the neighborhood.
David, this just in. President Abraham Lincoln was shot through the head last night at Ford's Theater and died this morning. The assassin is supposed to be J. Wilkes Booth, the actor. Secretary Stanton pronounced the president dead at 22 minutes after 7 o'clock, declaring, now he is for the ages. Andrew Johnson has been sworn in as the 17th president of these United States.
Wow. That is, that's very surprising and sobering news. I mean, here we are at the end of the Great War that's divided us. And it's a moment of national reconciliation. And for this to happen just as our president entered his second term is grave news. Let's consider this, though, Emily. What do you think the president's death does to the efforts to bring the secesh states back into the Union?
Why is that what you're concerned about now? The southern states? What about the people who live in them, whose rights have been trampled for all these years? What do we do to help all these black people who are newly free, who are going to need to gain their footing, are going to need help financially to get started, and who are going to need legal rights, which, you know, okay, we passed the 13th Amendment, but that does not get us where we need to go. Why is your first concern these states and their rights?
I mean, I think, Emily, we've had a terrible war, and I think it's, as I think President Johnson will articulate soon, this we have to stop thinking of ourselves as two nations, one blue and one gray, that we're kind of blue-gray nation now, and that the important thing that we need to do is to bring these states back into the Union very quickly, to let them recover from the war, and for the government in Washington to sort of focus on things like the Transcontinental Railroad, to focus on national issues, and not to concern itself so much with what's happened. John.
Look, it's
that Transcontinental Railroad. That's you one know, for the yeah, ages.
The
sure
Transcontinental
this is all,
Railroad look, is a very important it, issue, Emily.
So,
infrastructure.
You guys are both nuts. Let's think for a minute here about the horror of the thing. I mean, my mind is a whirl. There's not just the horror of his death, but you can't walk anywhere now in the aftermath without passing a building covered in crepe. People are in tears in the street. It's impossible to pass anybody who's not wearing a black armband. And this is the last casualty of the war. There will be other people who die. This is the last casualty of the war. And, I mean, as you know, my relationship with the president was strained. But
it was.
He was never clear whether you were a Republican or a Democrat, John.
And it never will be.
But, you know, a week before this happened, he had a dream. And he went down into the White House and saw an aide who he asked what happened. And they said, the president is dead. And yet, in conversation, he always said, I could wear chainmail and never be protected. No one will come assassinate the president. And so, like, he called his own killing, his own death.
John, I applaud your sense of the gravity of the moment, and I think it's you're right that this is a horror unknown in American history. We have, after you know, nearly 100 years, we have not had a president killed. We've never had our leader killed, and this is a change. But this is also a moment where the tide of history is moving very, very quickly. We have the war has ended, and we have to start to make very fast decisions about what's going to happen. And the time we spend in mourning over President Lincoln, a great captain of our country. The time we spend in mourning is time that is not spent in bringing Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina back into the Union and getting our troops home out of the South and in moving the country forward. I'm interested in like how we're going to deal with the radical Republicans who are going to be attempting to foist things right on this country when really we need to move forward.
So his idea was keep the Union, right? So how do you keep the Union? Do you punish or do you forgive? Right? You want to re-knit the Union? So what do you do with all those Confederate soldiers? It's okay, you're back in. Just pledge allegiance to the Union and you're back in.
I just don't see how the Confederate soldiers are a priority right
now. There are more of them and they are going to live in this portion of the country. What are you going to do with them? You can't ship them off to sea.
But there are also all these people who literally are destitute and need sustenance, need help figuring out how to live their own lives. And this is the window. This is the moment of opportunity to give them the kind of legal rights and the beginning of political power. And they don't even have equal rights under the law. It's very unclear who they are, legally speaking, and how we're going to make sure that they rise up.
Yeah, except that if you give them the vote, you'll have a revolt in the North. As well as the South.
Why? Why is there a Vulcan?
Because of all the people in the North who are fine with a union. And maybe even it's okay that they're free. But only Thaddeus Stevens and a few others feel like they should get the vote.
I think what you forget is that Emily is sort of an apologist for Senator Stevens. She's a stenographer for Senator Stevens' views.
I will take that over being an apologist for Andrew Johnson any day.
It is worth noting
President Johnson is going to be I'm interested, Emily, actually. Let's talk about this. What do you think President Johnson is going to have to do to win your vote in 1868? Oh wait, you don't have a vote. I forgot.
But I have a voice on this stage, and I don't think there's anything. I think the idea that Andrew Johnson is going to be the answer and that he can really stand in Lincoln's shoes. I mean, this is an enormous loss that the country is going to pay for a very long time. And
150 years?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the radical Republicans, with whom I do indeed at this moment identify, if never again, are going
You're
to
all
have
over
to
the
band
place.
Together and pass laws with a lot of strength over Johnson's veto so that we can make sure to protect the rights of the people who should be reconstructing the South. And those are not the people who just fought against us. Those people need to wait in line.
I mean, Emily, I'm correct in thinking you're a Hebrew, right? You're of the Hebrew religion?
Yes. Yeah.
So you know that the person who's going to enforce these is all these changes that you want to make in the South and the suffrage for the former slaves is General Grant, who tried to expel the Jews of Tennessee during the war.
You just went, wait, okay.
Do you know that? I mean, how do you feel as a Hebrew about that, about General Grant being the person who's going to carry these orders out?
Well, in fact, I am still stuck in my shtetl somewhere in Poland, but but I think that is not the priority right now. As important as religious freedom and religious rights are, and in fact, I think we could pass the kind of law and constitutional amendment that would guarantee equal protection to everyone and would include religious minorities along with racial minorities.
So, John, it's awfully soon to do this, but you know, I think one thing we want to think about is President Lincoln's legacy. How would you, of our 16 presidents, do you think he's in the top quarter with Presidents Washington and Jefferson and Polk? Or where do you think, or is he down with President Pierce and Buchanan, perhaps? Where do you think he's going to be?
Don't forget Millard Fillmore. Zachary Taylor, John Tyler, William Henry Harrison. Well, William Henry Harrison, we know he's 16. It was a terrible cold. Well, you've got Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Monroe, Adams, Jackson. So you got, you know, through the first seven.
So Lincoln maybe not,
you know. I mean, you've got half of the country thinks he's a tyrant. You know, I mean, he did run roughshod over the Constitution in furtherance of his aims.
It's funny, we didn't hear a lot about that from Emily, did we? About the suspension. Because I believe that Emily is a graduate of
I'm a pragmatist.
Yale University Law School.
Means versus ends on this one. It was a war. He unified the country. He saved the Union by fighting this terrible war. Stop right there.
I think in 150 years, people are going to really support that view.
Do you think they'll care a lot about the Transcontinental Railroad?
Yes, of course they will. Yeah, because of the Civil War changed the way, or I'll pose it as a question. It's the first act of collective action of this country. I mean, when
the revolt against the British was individual colonies banding together, but mostly as individuals. This creates a situation in which the United States is bound together in this, with a sense of union like it's never been before. So the Continental Railroad stitches that union together further as far as commerce is concerned. So we've had it now in war and in commerce. So the two are entwined.
Will you support an amendment to the Constitution that would guarantee equal rights and due process of law for everyone?
I mean, I really want to see what President Johnson's going to say about that.
I don't think he has long in the job.
Now we have a word from a new sponsor. The GabFest is sponsored this week by Dr. Rowell's Tonic Tablets. We come with glad tidings for all who are weak, with a message of hope to delicate women, puny children, and weak men. There is a new way to tint pale cheeks with the glow of health, new life for weak stomachs, weak nerves, and weak kidneys. Are you weaker, thinner, paler by the day with no energy, no appetite or strength, no desire for work or recreation, nervous, peevish, sleepless, sick of heart, and sore of limb? These are the conditions of countless sick men and women throughout these United States who are awaiting a message of hope and cheer. There is no excuse for you to be sick, for there's now a medicine that will heal you. Dr. Rowell's Tonic Tablets purify the blood, aid the kidneys, soothe the stomach, and sweeten the breath. Dr. Rowell's Tonics, which contain extracts of quinine, sarsaparilla, and pure cocaine of China, also regulate the liver and drive every single impurity out of the body. And of course, there's a special offer for GabFest listeners. Telegraph the word GabFest to Dr. E. Rowell, Utica, New York, for a free one-week supply of tablets with your order. I did. It's amazing. I had a cold earlier this winter. Look how hale and hearty I am.
That's right. Yesterday, he didn't have a beard.
I want to learn Morse code so we can all telegraph that.
We're going to telegraph. The telegraph operator can do it for you, Emily. Dr. Rowell's
Tonic
Tablets.
You just have to wait
tablets.
In line, like at the post office.
Oh, no.
Dr. Rowell's Tonic Tablets, they make sick people well. Back to the show. Let's go to... let's go to cocktail chatter when you're having your tonic tablet with a... I don't know what you would take it with. I'm not sure. Take it with the gin. Maybe it has quinine in it, so have it with some gin.
There's nothing that doesn't go well with gin.
What are you going to be chattering about?
Okay, can I go first?
You can go first, Emily.
It's always better. So I started watching belatedly the show Silicon Valley in the last July. All right, if people are watching that show, they watched it, at least a few of you out there. I watched it on the plane with one of my sons, which maybe shows very poor judgment on my part. In fact, surely it does. And the show is really funny and in some ways so spot on about Silicon Valley, and I especially love the Peter Thiel character. But the presentation of women in this show, while it may be accurate in terms of portraying the gender imbalance in Silicon Valley, is completely infuriating. This is a house of men. Finally, a woman coder appears at a conference late in season one, and she doesn't know how to code. She really sucks at it, and she has to ask the guys for help coding. I had like steam coming out of my ears, and I kept thinking of a bunch of Stanford students I talked to earlier this year. And in college at Stanford, the number of women majoring in computer science is really growing. They are there. They're a presence. They're not tokens. And for them to see this show and have no representation at all of any woman with any computer science skills, I just think it's completely infuriating. So, Mike Judge, come on, next season, let's show us a girl who can code.
John,
you go, David.
All right, I'll go. Yours is good. I'll go. So I got an interesting email this week from an old friend of mine named Martin Tom, and it just there's not really a peg to this except that Martin emailed me, and it was just I just want to tell a story about him. So I was 12 years ago, I was traveling in Africa doing a story for Slate about famine, and I was supposed to go from Ethiopia, which had a famine, down to Zimbabwe, which also had a famine. And I had a connection in a country that I had not heard of, or I'd heard of the country, but it was a city I hadn't heard of. So it was Lilongwe, Malawi. I had to make my airplane connection in Lilongwe. And I get to Lilongwe, and I was catching an Air Zimbabwe plane, and you get to Lilongwe, and there is no Air Zimbabwe plane because Air Zimbabwe has decided that they can't send the plane, and they're not going to send it for several more days, at which point I had a ticket home. So I was stuck in this country that I didn't know anything about and with nothing to do. And as I was walking to the terminal, a young man, a Malawian, struck up a conversation with me, and he turned out his name was Martin Tom, and he was a Pentecostal pastor. And he was a Pentecostal pastor, and he was on his way back from a revival meeting in Uganda. And we just started talking. He was incredibly nice. And then I got stranded. I was there at customs, and I couldn't get into the country, and they finally just gave me a one-day visa. And Martin waited for me, and he said, you know, why don't you come home with me? And so I was like, well, why not? And so we started talking. We were waiting at the airport, and we started talking. He was excited beyond excited that I was Jewish, and he kept saying, you know, we're both sons of Abraham. You're a son of Abraham. I'm a son of Abraham. And he just kept saying, you know, the Lord has sent you to me for a reason, David. And I was like, I don't think so, but maybe. And so he brings me home, and he introduces me to his wife and his baby, who cries. The baby had never seen a white person before, and was like cried every time he saw me. It was disturbing. And he actually gave me the shoes off his feet. He gave me his sandals because I can't remember why, but for some reason I didn't have
shoes. You had no shoes.
I had no shoes that
we
could wear,
airport.
And so he gave me his sandals. And he put me up and showed me around town for a couple of days, and was unbelievably, he was just like the most hospitable, wonderful, generous host. And he kept saying, you know, the Lord sent me to you for a reason. And so I ended up going home, but I wrote a story for Slate because I couldn't write a story about going to Zimbabwe because I wasn't there. So I just wrote a story about this guy and how he'd been nice to me and how he was a Pentecostal pastor. And so what happened was Martin at that point had a church of 50 people that met in a basement in the long way, and he just quit being an insurance salesman, and that was what he was trying to do with his life. And so I wrote the story about him, and I started to get emails from Pentecostals in the U.S. saying, we hear about Brother Martin's mission in Malawi. It's great. Can we get in touch with him? And so I started to put Pentecostals in the U.S. in touch with Martin back in Malawi. And then one of the leading Pentecostal pastors in the U.S. said, I'm going to go do a mission. I'm going to do a revival in Malawi because it seems like there are a lot of Christians in Malawi. And so he had Martin come in and be his kind of sidekick for this mission in Malawi. And this happened over and over again. And ultimately, Martin... This was during the Bush years, and so we started to get some of that money that the Bush folks were spending on faith-based programs overseas, and Martin got some of that, and he became the leading pastor in Malawi because of all this money that started to come in and all this American effort, and he's sort of become like the James Carville of Malawi. He's also the campaign manager for the leading presidential candidate, and... It was this weird thing where he thought, okay, God has sent you, David Plotz, to me for a reason. And it turned out that he was right. Yeah. And it's been as a person who is, is an atheist and a Jew and someone who has absolutely no patience at all for the theology that Martin teaches and, no interest in it. The fact that this act of kindness from him and this act of generosity, this act of faith of him, 12 years ago has led in for him in return to this incredible prosperity and opportunity is sort of humbling. Anyway,
you like the patron saint of Malawi?
He was his no, I don't think so. But he did invite me to the presidential inauguration, but his candidate lost, so I didn't get to go.
Right.
He lost
next
by one point. What is your chatter, John?
That was fantastic. Plus, you got a chatter out of it, so you got something too.
There you go.
it's not the preservation of your soul for eternity, but it is a chatter. Every journey starts with the first step.
Exactly. In someone else's sandals.
I find myself. At a deficit here after those two.
No, you have great. You're going to pull out your great pamphlet.
Just do it. Come on.
I'm very nervous. Okay, so I'm going to read to you from a little pamphlet I have here called The Serious Lesson in President Harding's Case of Gonorrhea. Now, some of you may remember this from childhood. I don't know. Nothing goes better with milk and cookies at night.
Dramatic reading?
It's going to be a whole thing. So it starts by saying the late President Harding suffered from the plague of untaught youths, and we should add the plague of uninformed or careless adults, the all too familiar venereal disease known as gonorrhea. Now, you may wonder why I'm reading you from this pamphlet.
No, well, I wonder why it exists.
Yeah. So I came across this in some presidential research that I've been doing about old presidents. And you may remember also, by the way, there was a GabFest that I wasn't on, damn it, that in which you talked about his love letters. President Harding, as everybody will remember, was quite an amorous fellow. And and he had several affairs. His longest one was with Carrie Phillips, who he described in his letter as having pillowing breasts, and a variety of other things that I won't go into. But you had a long discussion. Leibovitz was on the show about this.
I thought it was Jeff Goldberg. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was
it
go
Goldberg?
On.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Randy fellow. So what struck me is that this exists. And what this is it's one of these pamphlets. It's not the only one. There's the only one about Harding. He wasn't that Randy. But they were called Little Blue Books, and they were published between, under a variety of different names, between 1919 and 1978 by a person named E. Haldeman Julius. And these pamphlets were basically like the, for me anyway, in my theory of the case, like the internet before we had the internet, which was that they covered, you could sign up and you'd get five of them in the mail, and they came under, they were called Appeals Pocket Series, People's Pocket Series, the 10-cent pocket. And they would come to your house and they would be on crazy different subjects. I mean, some of them would be very straight ahead. One was how to write business letters. So you'd get your packet of five, and one would be how to write business letters and Harding's gonorrhea. But I guess my point about the internet is that they had the secrets. They had the stuff that you didn't read about in school, that your parents didn't teach you about, that you didn't hear about at church. And it was like this strange, amazing, wonderful stuff that was hidden from you. And the others, some of the others in the selections, there was something called the Knowledge of Life series, which had a
that
series.
That sounds like Scientology.
You mean my previous description? Or
no,
the knowledge of life?
Life
well, except the Knowledge of Life series was all about, one of the books was called The Sex Factor for Men.
Oh.
And there was The Sex Factor for Women. And this was where you learned about all the stuff that your parents ran from the room and didn't talk about. Then there was Wild Cats in Petticoats, A Garland of Desperados. So you could read that in your leisure hours.
That may have been what President Harding had read.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's like, where are these wildcats?
What is the serious lesson? Is there a teacher?
So, okay, sorry. And then my other one was a tour of Europe for stay-at-homes. But anyway, the reason I... which is really like the internet, right? I don't have to go anywhere. Look, Stad. But what I love about them is both the antiquated writing and this idea of like letting you in on secrets from a time where conspiracies kind of seem gentle. And so I'll just read you the actual case they make, though, makes perfect sense, right? We're doing this unusual thing in calling attention forcibly to the venereal malady which afflicted the late President Harding. We are making a sensational story of this hidden chapter in President Harding's life. We are daring to speak plainly. We're casting overboard conventional notions of politeness and of what is or isn't fit to print. It is our conviction that the truth is fit to print, and that it is especially our duty to print the truth when it involves a great lesson of health, happiness, and social sanity. False shame and silence have ruined thousands. Ah, the toll is countless of those who have suffered misery and defeat and the deepest tragedy because they were victims of the ignorance and obscurantism cultivated by Puritans who opposed plain speaking about sex. So, totally modern, thorough, and reasonable, but in like 1931, was scandalous and secret and crazy.
I find it bizarre and hypocritical for you, John, who can't stand it when we talked about John Edwards's peccadilloes, to be like, oh, let's talk about Warren Harding's VD. It's okay if it's an old-timey font.
Well, that's true of basically anything. But also, I think the case is that more people suffered from gonorrhea in the United States and the world than suffered from getting caught in a hotel while visiting their mistress, which was the case with John Edwards. So I think the public policy case they make here is slightly stronger
public
than the one
health.
You were making. As you know, my concern for public health knows no bounds.
Anyway, and I also love like the way they're this is a reprint, of course, but they were all like packaged in like, well, this is a Field Notes, but they're all like these, like I love little
a really little, old Field little, Notes. It's like falling apart.
Well, it's just a month old. Okay. I just carried it in my back pocket. But the point is, they had these like this neat little like collect the whole set. You know, they had a kind of, I don't know, a nice antiquated look to them too. So it appeals to every one of my fetishes, other than the actual subject matter of the book.
Our intern who helped organize the show is Tarek Barrett. Our producer and the managing producer of Slate Podcast is Joel Meyer. Aaron Bergen organized this live show for us. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. It has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest, and our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the Gabfest in iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. Every single person in this room, go leave a comment and rating, please. It really helps us. You can search for Slate Political Gabfest in the iTunes store. Thank you to the Bell House for having us again. We will come back. We were here for Kennedy's assassination, the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, 150 for Lincoln. Not sure when we'll be back again. Not sure what the next good assassination anniversary is. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week. We're not going to have time for all questions. I'm just warning you. So,
sorry.
Sorry.
Quick question, and sort of related to last week's topic as well. And last week, you all were discussing about Iran and the issues maybe for the presidential campaign. And one thing that was brought up when David was talking about Iran and how it's a lot more normal and he was getting chastised as a lot more dangerous, actually, than is being portrayed. My question is this, is why is it today with the Iran deal that there's all this talk about the dangers of Iran and all the things that could happen with this, and yet there's absolutely no talk at all from these same people raising alarms about the country of Saudi Arabia, which is so much further along in terms of supporting some of the worst types of terrorism out there, especially the sort of the Sunni radicalism that is the sort of kind of terrorism that actually does go international, a country that does not recognize Israel, a country that is poisoning these all over the world in terms of what they are promoting, and yet no politician pays a price ever for their associationship with Saudi Arabia. And secondly, is there some sort of sophisticated lobby? Everyone always talks about the Israeli lobby. It's a bit of a, you know, too much. Does the Saudi lobby, is it really that strong on Capitol Hill that nobody's able to speak against this country?
Well, I certainly think there's a lot to your point of view about Saudi Arabia. I mean, if you think about where the dangerous Islamic radicalism is coming, it's coming from, not necessarily from Saudi Arabia or the Saudi government, but from people who are sort of connected closer to them than they are certainly connected to the Iranian government. And yeah, I mean, the ties that the Saudis have in Washington are enormous. They've cultivated them incredibly well over the years. There have been books written about them. I think, don't they have, the Saudis have very close ties to the Bush family in particular, right? Because they all, this oil culture. Yeah, I think it's a very legitimate question. It's a less democratic country than Iran, and it's not to say that you know there's a contest and Iran is great and Saudi Arabia is terrible, but I agree like that the fact that we give the Saudis a complete free pass on these issues is strange.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's part of one is in plays ball with the United States and one doesn't. I think it's a great question, set of questions. One thing that's been explained to me, or one example that's been given to me as for why this relationship exists the way it does is, and so I'm a little out of my depth here and I'm just repeating what's been told to me, is that if you look at our relationship with Russia, and Russia, if you keep oil prices low, Russia doesn't have as much money coming in from their biggest single moneymaker. And so how do you keep oil prices low? That's basically Saudi Arabia helps the United States do that by agreeing to keep oil prices low. And so Saudi Arabia is helping the U.S. put pressure on Russia. Now, that's one of somebody who's expert in this knows lots of other ways in which the United States is helped by Saudi Arabia and therefore looks the other way in the same way the United States does in a lot of other instances. But that would just be one thing I'd point to.
Okay, we're just going to do three more questions. I'm sorry to all you folks back there. We just don't have time. Thank you.
Hi, Scott from Philadelphia. I just want to thank you guys. Thank you. Thank you very much for years of joyful, insightful political coverage. I wake up every Friday and just say, woot, it's Political Gabfest Day. Love it. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. So my question is, it seems like the Democrats are walking into a huge tactical mistake. So Hillary's presumptive, and to me, just understanding time. So what's happening is, we elected our first black president. We re-elected our first black president. The Democrats think we're immediately going to elect our first female president. To me, just understanding the elasticity of history, time, and math means this is a deadlock loss if the Republicans run any traditional candidate. Am I wrong, and why?
Well, you're right. It's not often the case that also you have
the third.
The way you do. On the other hand, you've got demographic changes and other changes that help Democrats. So in furtherance of your theory, especially if the Republican candidate, say, comes from Florida and has a good chance of winning that state, which takes a big and important battleground state off the map, I think there's a lot. I think there's too much in play right now to argue either that you're totally right and it's a lock, or to really make and build a strong case against you. I mean, so you know, the first woman candidate ever, perhaps to be a party nominee. Who knows what that's going to do to the woman's vote? And that's going to matter in a lot of those battleground states. And so what's that going to mean? And what's the Republican primary going to look like? There's a lot of money. Ted Cruz's super PACs just announced today they've raised $31 million. That's going to drop on someone's head. And what's that going to do? And then then multiply that by all the candidates. Everybody's going to have an outside force that's going to smash their opponents. So what's that going to do to the Republican side? Now, they may spend a lot of the money beating up on Hillary Clinton. She's going to be, you know, the first, if things continue as they are, the first really uncontested candidate since 1908. And so she's going to be a sitting duck for all these attacks from all these Republicans. So what's that going to do to her? And I just think there are so many variables. But it's a great way to think about this race, that question.
I think the fact that she's a woman is the best thing she has going for her in this sort of third term scenario, because it's exciting. It's a first. It's trailblazing. It's much better than being the second Clinton.
Hi, Byron from Brooklyn. So I'm a big fan, and I've really appreciated the way that you guys have acknowledged that when you speak about issues that directly affect people of color, that you haven't always had a person of color on the panel to bring a different and relevant perspective. I wanted to know from each one of you if you really felt like the latest instance of Walter Scott being murdered in South Carolina was really different, because each of you, it seemed like you thought there was something about this that was really legitimately different, that would change the way that people of color are treated by law enforcement. Because given that Trayvon Martin, a child, was killed without consequence, and Eric Garner was murdered, a police officer murdered Eric Garner with his bare hands on video without consequence, I have a hard time believing that Walter Scott's case will legitimately change the way that people of color are treated in this country.
I wouldn't presume to know the answer, but they're different. So the Garner case was different because although Garner was murdered by a cop, it was not a cop who was attempting to murder him. It was a cop who murdered him, by accident is the wrong term, but he murdered him doing something that probably wouldn't have murdered other people. And in the case of in Ferguson, there was no video. There was such ambiguity about what the evidence was. I guess I think that this case, the Walter Scott case, may be different because it is the cop is attempting to murder and succeeds in murdering this person who is clearly no threat and is innocent. And there is not a lot of there's going to be. I mean, he'll mount a defense which will claim he's endangered. But I think it's the more extreme case of these two, and whether it will change what happens, I have no idea. But I do think it occupies a different space, I hope.
And I guess the other way of looking at this is these are building blocks. This is a long-term struggle. It's not going to change overnight. And this may not be the case that creates national change quickly, but there's a momentum building, and we can all see what happened here in a way that's very stark. It's hard for me to imagine the kind of backlash defense of this police officer, and in each of the other cases, maybe with the exception of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was killed in Cleveland, there's been now having said that, I guess there's already a fund for the defense of Michael Slager, so maybe I'm wrong about that.
One more question. Here we go.
It seems to me like, with all due condemnation of Rolling Stone publishing hokum every 30 years, it doesn't seem to me any worse than you see nightly on Fox News. We've lost Stephen Colbert. We're about to lose Jon Stewart. How do we get the Columbian?
I think
Columbia
they can still be found.
I hope so.
I believe, yeah.
How do we get the Columbian like an app for that review you can... to do an analysis of Fox News Daily?
I think they've done it. I mean, that's everyone. It's a known thing. Is the problem? It's that it doesn't
matter to the audience.
It doesn't matter to the audience, right? So that's the issue. Thank you guys so much. This is a great show. Please come back to the Bell House. We love being here with you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.